Hello! Welcome back to the Long Distance Love Bombs podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jeremy Goldberg, and today's episode is with my guest, Jeremy Allen. Aside from having a wonderful first name, Jeremy is a grief and loss educator. He is a funeral director, he is an embalmer of bodies, and he helps individuals, communities, and professionals to navigate the discomfort that comes from grief and loss. He suggests that grief is our emotional and behavioral response to loss. It's not specifically death. And in this episode, which I admit might sound a little bit morbid based on what I've just told you, we actually have a very uplifting, optimistic, high vibe conversation about loss and death and grief. And what is the healthy way to grieve? What does it mean to lose somebody close to you? What does he, as an expert who's been in this field for over a decade, what does he have to say about it? What is there to learn about it? It's a powerful, fun, beautiful conversation. Jeremy shares very openly about a few experiences that he has had related to his personal life as well as his professional career, and even one story where those two things intersected in a really interesting manner. So I think that you actually are going to learn a lot. I did. And I think it's a powerful conversation worth listening to and sharing. So thank you for being here. And without further ado, here is Jeremy Allen. My podcast host's radar was going off. Like, we need to just dive in because you sound like you're ready to roll.
Yeah. So,
all right, Jeremy Allen, welcome to the podcast. And please rant away.
Cool. Well, I'll reconnect and maybe properly introduce myself and create some context to this connection and where the knowledge is going to be based out of. So my name is Jeremy Allen. I'm, you know, part of a platform called Death Ed, which is death education. And specifically what it is it's a place for me to take my knowledge over my 15 plus years as a funeral director and embalmer and use that knowledge and all of these lessons that we've learned from joining family and some of, you know, the deepest parts of loss and taking very tangible lessons about grief and reapplying them into new environments. So I feel very privileged and grateful to be here with you today, just recognizing this is just another opportunity for grief to have a seat at the table. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's an honor and a privilege. And just before we started recording, we agreed that it is the year of the Jer.
Yeah.
Because we share a name. And we also were, or I was sharing with you that we got connected on Instagram and we checked out your page and I felt really excited and really called to provide a platform for you to share a lot of your experiences and insights, because as a society, as I'm certain that you know, but we don't talk about death and we don't talk about grief nearly enough. And I think that's to the detriment of all of us. And so I'm hopeful that over the next 45 minutes or an hour or however long it goes, that we can just voice that. And I have so many questions for you as a dude who is a funeral director / embalmer. Just last night, my girlfriend's like, what was that movie with Dan Aykroyd and Macaulay Culkin?
Yeah, My Girl.
My Girl. And I was like, yeah, I'm interviewing Dan Aykroyd essentially tomorrow. I'm fired up. Okay, so you are a funeral director. You are an embalmer. Mm-hmm. And I would say you're like an expert in death and grief. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, one of the things I'm really invested in is, you know, what allows us to become experts in our fields is either formal education or experience. And I've ultimately spent my entire adult life, you know, in the trenches of loss with families that have experienced death. And, you know, from being willing to be vulnerable and sit at the table with them without judgment or expectation, has just created a really unique perspective. And for me, learning opportunities to really understand grief at a personal level, even though I've not experienced, obviously, all of those personal relationships that were attached to loss.
Right. So maybe we can start from the beginning a little bit, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
So how did
you, because you're not that old and you've got 15 years of experience in this area.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you got into this in your 20s somehow.
Yeah. So I was actually like fresh out of high school, and it's like, it wasn't a fairy tale beginning. Like I, in my grade 12 year of high school, so I was 18 at the time, I grew up in rural Alberta. My dad was the vice principal of the school that I went to. And we just grew up in a setting where it was like 18 year olds needed to decide what they were going to do for the rest of their life. Right. Which probably we could do a whole nother podcast on, like, the ridiculous amount of pressure we put on kids. And I was just like really stuck in this place of like, you know, I like the idea of teaching. I liked the idea of like connecting with people. So like when you plotted me out on the chart, it was like, well, either become a teacher or youth pastor was another one. But the simple reality of those two things is I don't like school, and I partied quite a bit. So, you know, like between the partying and the swearing, becoming a youth pastor wasn't a real strong fit either. And so fast forward to like the end of that school year, I ended up so in Alberta, we have to write diplomas. That was, I guess, 18 years ago. I feel like there's still an equivalence of that taking place. But I actually got caught cheating on my social 30 diploma and almost got expelled. And again, circling back to my dad being the vice principal at that point in time, which led to a reasonable amount of drama, and made my way through that experience, wrote a wonderful letter of apology, you know, rewrote my test, did better not cheating, but that's besides the point. And ended up graduating. And it was like, we were on our way back from Edmonton. That's where I had to go rewrite the test. And my parents were just like, hey, so your aunt works at a funeral home in Calgary and they're looking for some help. We think it would be a great opportunity for you. And I was like, not a chance. Like in what world, you know, do you imagine me moving to Calgary to work for a funeral home? Like, this was not on my radar. And it was like, oh no, you didn't hear. We're going to Calgary. Like, you're going to go and interview at this because you're 18 and you need to figure out what you're doing with your life, right? And so I went down to Calgary, worked for a big funeral home there for about a year. And actually, like, there were a lot of things that I really enjoyed about it, you know, and the number one thing I think I've been in tune with for my entire career, which has allowed me to have a lot of like personal connection and relationship, is the recognition of the opportunity we have to make relationship in the vulnerability of loss. Mm-hmm. Right. I wouldn't have those words when I was 18, but looking back at it, I think that was the thing even then made me, you know, reasonably good at what I was doing. But I just got homesick. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. Do you recall what the interview was like as an 18-year-old with no experience?
So to give you like some context, my wife and I own a funeral home here in Alberta now. We're in rural Alberta, and we serve about 70 families a year. The funeral home that I work for in Calgary would serve like close to 3,000 families a year. So it was like, and I met with like the owner, like that was my entry interview. And I remember like pissing my pants. I was 18 years old meeting with this like funeral mogul. And he was like so good, but so goddamn intimidating, where it was just like, I've got some real concerns, Jeremy, about your history here, you know, like the integrity of some of these decisions you've been making. And I was like, no, I understand that. And, you know, but then it was just able to say, like, you know, that isn't my strength. Like, you know, knowing that school wasn't my strength, or knowing that, you know, the things, my driving record at the time was not a real strength either. And real concerns for this guy. But then was just able to, you know, connect on that personal level and say, like, you know, even in that entry interview, of knowing that the opportunity of serving people in a time of, you know, high need was very attractive to my personality, you know, all that. And again, not having the words or the experience to probably have said that then, but I just felt really connected to it from a young age.
Yeah. So there was part of you that had an awareness that was interested, or your curiosity was piqued, and you thought, like, maybe I actually could do this job.
Yeah. 100%. And I think that's what it was. And I was really attracted to, you know, because part of that, as you said, do you think you would ever go to school for this? And my response was, I could see myself becoming a funeral director, you know, sitting at the table, serving families. embalming did not interest me, just the entirety of the experience. Like it was not that attractive to me, but then that just came down to functionality where, you know, in order to, at that point in time in funeral service, you know, to enter into that career, you were just much more of an asset to be funeral director and embalmer, because then, you know, depending on what was required from day to day is, and, you know, I value that now in my setting, you know, where you can completely serve, you know, like that, like from the time we bring somebody back to our care, I'm completely capable of taking care of that person. Whereas if I only would have went ahead with just getting my funeral directing, you know, I would have needed to have either more staff or, you know, find more support and things like that to help with that. So, but yeah, I mean, embalming still to this day is not the favorite part of my job. I think I have a really high level of respect for what it is and the science attached to it. It's a really incredible process when you look at it from the lens of, you know, the anatomy and physiology of what we're able to do, but much prefer these experiences of like, I'd way rather sit in a podcast and talk about death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you be okay sitting on a podcast talking about embalming for a few minutes?
Yeah, definitely, man.
So
yeah.
I've never, to my knowledge, met anybody that is an embalmer.
Okay.
So do you mind just talking about that? Like, what is it like to embalm a body? What is involved? What are the steps? Like,
yeah, so it's super unique to each individual, you know, of course, like depending on the way and the cause and manner of death, you know, but to simplify it, like the purpose of embalming is preservation, sanitization, and restoration, to obviously to preserve and sanitize the body, you know, to make it safe from a public health and safety perspective for people that want to come and view and touch the body or kiss the body. So again, like that really leans into like the cultural aspects of death, you know, because cultures are so different in the way that they mourn and in the way that they spend time with the body. And then the restoration is, you know, really what that means is just like, you know, to try to recreate a very natural appearance of who that person is, you know, that it doesn't serve anybody well that if you embalm and the, you know, the way that person looks is no longer them, right? And that certainly can happen. But the goal is, so embalming is actually called arterial injection. So the science of it is, you know, in the anatomy of the body, there are six main injection sites, which is your two carotid arteries, your two femoral arteries, which are in the upper part of your legs, and then your brachial or axial or axillary arteries, which are like kind of in your armpit and in down into the bicep. And so just again, depending on sometimes like with circulation or sometimes like, you know, with certain conditions, basically what happens is like, I know people won't see this because you're the only one that will see me, not in a podcast, but so like if you imagine like the artery is when we raise the artery, so we make a small incision, we find the artery, and so we raise it. So basically we have these instruments that allow us to find them and bring them to the surface. And then we make a small incision in the artery and we inject something called a cannula, and that goes inside of the artery. And then that's what, you know, runs with the hose and attaches to the embalming machine. And then the embalming machine basically operates like your heart. And so this arterial solution, which is typically formaldehyde based, you know, is injected into the arterial system. And like the embalming machine pumps like a heart would. And that's what like creates the circulation to distribute that arterial solution throughout the body. Right. Mm. And yeah. And then we, you know, in each of those injection sites where there's an artery, there's a vein, and we will like make an incision in the vein so that the blood is actually then not like, it's just as the blood circulates the body, it exits the body through that incision, because the blood is the thing that will eventually start to break down and decompose and create, you know, decomposition and color issues and things like that.
And so you're essentially replacing all of the blood in the person with a preservation material.
Yeah, exactly. I would say like that's a very, very close idea of what happens. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what is it like when you're in a room with what's the right word to say it? A corpse?
Yeah, I don't, corpse. I mean, I always say a body.
A body. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sensitive to language.
Yeah.
So you're in a room, you've got a body, And you've got this machine and you are working on a body. Like, what is, do you put music on? Like, what?
Yeah. So I'm a music guy. Definitely. Like, you know, we get Spotify rolling. You know, we listen to some music. I mean, it's just, I just try to create an environment that becomes comfortable for me. I always have all the lights on because I'm afraid of the dark, which is sort of hilarious for a person that works in the setting that I work in. Yeah. But yeah, like back, funeral homes are creepy as shit at night. It's just like, I don't care like where you're at with your universe or your God or your whatever spirituality, but it's just like, there's just something unnerving about being in a funeral home after hours. And yeah, so I mean, I'm definitely a music guy. Like I, and like, to me, it is like the best way for me to care for somebody that's passed away is to make sure that like I'm in an environment that's as comfortable as possible. Because if I'm comfortable, I'm confident. And once I'm confident, I'm going to have a much easier time drawing on the knowledge and experience that I need to get through, you know, specific embalmings, you know, because again, some can be very straightforward. So something that we would call a single point injection, meaning like where we just have to raise the carotid, and others can be really complicated where sometimes you're raising all six or seven or eight different places to try to get that proper distribution. And you know, if it's a car accident, if it's anything traumatic, you know, then there's restorative work to do. And so it's just like, to me, the embalming room is like, it's a very respectful process. But my big thing is like for the embalmer, it needs to be an environment that they're comfortable in, because confidence comes over comfortability.
Yeah. And it sounds like there's an element of honor throughout the entire process. When you receive the body, you work on the body, you present the body, you dispose of the body.
Yeah. And you know, and the reality of this is when we talk in generic settings like this, we'll also use the word body or the deceased or whatever the case is. But when we are specifically caring for somebody, like, you know, when you talk about the intention of words, right? Well, that person is still a person. I recognize life has left that body, but that shell is extremely important, you know? So it is still Mrs. Smith. It is still, you know, like, you know, that there is still a person attached to this shell or to this body, you know, and I recognize the separation in those two things. But my big thing is just like, you know, I guess my own personal beliefs or philosophies is just like, even though it is a shell that served a very important purpose, you know, for moms and for grandmas. Like, these are literally shells that housed other living beings, you know, and grew other people, you know. Like, how important is that, that they're respectfully cared for, right? Or like the we live in a really like heavy agriculture area, right? You know, like, I just think of some of these, you know, old generational men that come, you know, through our care, and like, you just, the stories that those hands could tell, you know, from having to be strong enough to, you know, to fix machinery, but then soft enough to like to bring a calf back to life that had a bad delivery. Like, it's just like, you know, and you start to really attach meaning to the body, and it's an incredible thing, and it deserves an incredible amount of respect. I think the thing that we as funeral professionals have the ability to do is to now like take that respect and kind of, I think, redefine the ways in which we're able to provide care, that it's not always going to look in the same traditional aspects that we've seen over the last few generations, right? That it's not always going to be embalming, that it's not always going to be burial or cremation, you know, like, where we're really now having to learn a lot about different ways to care for people. Like, I mean, I don't know much about it. I won't be able to speak to it to a high level, but like you can literally be like buried in the pod of a tree now, you know, turned into a tree, right? Like, yeah. Just like, so like, there's just so many incredible ways for us to learn how to honor at a higher level. But at the base of it all for me is just like a genuine care for the person that's passed away, because even though it's a shell, and regardless of the simplicity or the extravagant wishes that this person has in place, you know, those basic levels of care, I think, are important in every setting.
Have you ever had someone that you've, I don't know, worked on? I'm so sensitive with the length. Have you ever had a body come through in your professional capacity and it was somebody that you knew personally?
Yeah, I'll tell you probably the craziest experience I've had on a personal level.
Jeez, yeah.
I'm trying to remember exactly how many years ago. It was probably, I think it was in 2014 when my grandfather passed away. And like it was about 6 weeks before my grandpa died. He was remarried. And like, so a few years before that, my grandmother had passed away. And I wasn't a part of her funeral. It was another funeral home that helped care for her. And then, so fast forward a few years, my grandpa gets remarried at the age of 75, which I need you to know, like on the record, I was such a fan of it. Like, you know, because I love relationship and connection. And like, we got to experience such a different side of our grandpa because of that relationship. He got his first passport at the age of 75, right? Like him and my biological grandma never traveled, you know, a lot of it was attached to her health. And so it's like, it was almost like my grandpa's retirement really began after my grandma passed away, because he got, you know, like those caretaker roles that he'd been playing for all of their retirement were no longer, right? And then he ended up meeting this person. And I remember, so it was like within months of my grandma passing away was when we moved and bought this funeral home in rural Alberta, which put me very close to where I grew up. And I was having coffee with him, like it was like 6 months after my grandma had passed away. And we were talking about grief and we were talking about it all. And he said, you know, like, Jer, like what I'm doing right now is not living. There's no life attached to the approach I'm taking, you know, and where just basically like the reality of just of sitting alone in the presence of his grief and not having the emotional intelligence or ability to talk his way through it, it was extremely lonely for him. And so he basically, he just said like, you know, I think I need to try and get back out into the world. And I was like in full in favor of this. So he ended up reconnecting with this wonderful person from his past, from, you know, his much younger days. And they started going to these dances again, right? Like all this really lovely stuff. And we're probably going to have to use the full 90 minutes that you gave us because
go for your life, man.
So what was so funny about this experience was that when my grandpa got back into this world of dating, which is such a funny concept to consider, but like, you know, now my grandpa's re-entering the you know, the market. Thank God he didn't hear of Tinder. But it was like every time he said he wasn't going to do something, it would happen. So it was like, you know, he reconnects with Ellie. And it was just like, we're just spending time together. We're just going to a few dances. It's not like we're dating or anything, you guys, right? And then it was like, all of a sudden, that, well, we're dating, okay? And then, but then this is how he announces it. Well, you know, we are dating now. We thought you guys should know, but like, it's, you guys don't need to panic. It's not like we're getting married or anything. and then it was like, within a few months of that, they're engaged and going to be living together, right? And like, it was, so when it came out that he was getting engaged and that he was going to sell his house and move in with Eleanor, my Uncle Bob, like after this like little family supper or whatever, like Grandpa Nelly left and he looks at my dad, my uncle looks at my dad and goes, I swear to God, if he tells us it's not like they're going to have kids, I'm going to lose it. but like what I love so much about being in a part of these experiences is recognizing, you know, generationally how much has changed about how we communicate about emotion, you know, and again, grief is just like, to me, it is one of the most emotional spaces that we will ever participate in. So that's just to give you a little idea of like this relationship I had with my grandpa. So like fast forward a little bit. So now he's got his passport. Him and Eleanor start going down to Yuma for the winters. And it was their second winter. They were about to leave and they weren't sure if they were going to go because health insurance is just such a ripoff these days. And you know, I said to him, I was like, well, like grandpa, like go, like at some point in time, you're not going to be able to travel. So like, you know, take these opportunities if you can afford to do it. And they went down and that year they decided not to come home for Christmas just because of functionality. It seemed like a good idea. But then they came home in early February. And in that timeline, we actually, our community had a community member that passed away in Yuma. And we helped the family like get this person back home into our care and did everything that we did. And when he came home, he was asking about it. He was inquisitive. He said, what was that like? Like, how did you get this person home? So I explained everything to him and he asked, you know, my thoughts on it. I said, honestly, if I could recreate that opportunity, I said at a minimum, what I wish I would have done I wish I would have offered to go to Yuma and help get them home, you know, because there was just there were enough things that happened in that process that I felt really interfered with that family's grief, you know, that I wish we maybe would have advocated for them at a higher level, and maybe they wouldn't have done anything differently, but I wish as the professional that they trusted to walk alongside them, I wish I would have had the willingness to offer, you know, even though that would have been a very non-traditional approach, that I would have offered that, you know, opportunity to fly down and make sure everything was the way that it was supposed to be and make sure that they got home, you know, in all the ways that it was supposed to happen. And so I explained this all to my grandpa and that made a lot of sense to him. And then like, no bullshit, like less than 6 weeks later, him and Ellie are out at a dance down in Yuma and he kind of wasn't feeling good. So they sat down and he caught his breath. And then he said to her, he said, you know, like, we didn't come here to sit at the table. Let's get back out there. And they stood back up and three steps onto the dance floor, my grandpa collapsed and died before he hit the floor. They had something happening with his ascending aorta that nobody knew about. And he passed away. And it was just like, just this really weird, you know, entry into that grief because A, it was my grandpa. And like, I was extremely close with this grandparent. You know, like this is the guy that literally like taught me how to hunt, taught me how to throw a ball, taught me how to fish, like, you know, like drove me to hockey. Like, you know, like he was very much an extension of my parents because I grew up in a generation that my grandparents were very involved in my childhood. And I'm going to have an emotional delivery because relationship is so important. And the thing I've learned about emotion is like, it's just so necessary. Because even though it's been almost 7 years since my grandpa died, like I still feel his presence. Like he's still very much a part of my life. And so like talking about his death is, it's still difficult and that's okay. Because what I look at when I look back at this experience and, you know, unpacking, you know, the conversations we had right before him dying and then into the days of his death was, I remember saying to my wife, I was like, I need to go get him. Like, I need to get him home. You know, I need to be a part of that. And I failed my nuclear family, I think, a lot in some of the decisions that I made, which we might need to do a three-piece segment on this, but because I kind of went into funeral director mode in order to do that. But to get back to this question of like the most personal embalming that I've ever had is I actually flew to Yuma and embalmed my own grandfather. And I remember like my dad and my brother and my uncle and I all flew down and because we were going to go pack up his things. It's like, well, when I went to the funeral home, they were going to pack up his things and they were going to help Eleanor with some of her stuff. And one of Eleanor's kids flew down as well so that they could fly her home. And then my dad and my brother were going to bring the vehicle back and my uncle and I would fly home together. Anyway, I remember going to the funeral home and I wish I could remember the name of the funeral home, but like they were so incredible because, you know, I just feel like if I got a call from somebody, like if I completely reverse this, it was like, hey, you know, my grandfather just died in Provost, Alberta, and I'm from Yuma. Do you mind if I come and bomb him? I would be like, yeah, pardon me. You know, like I think I would be reasonably skeptical about the idea. But they were so good to me and they allowed me to come and I remember walking into the room and I just said, like, you know, if possible, can you please just have him on the prep table and, you know, like maybe have him cleaned up and stuff just so that like my initial experience with him is as pleasant as possible. But then I'll do everything else. And I just remember walking in and I remember seeing his lifeless body on the prep table. And it was such a, like why I love grief. And I mean that, like, I mean, like I'm so unapologetic about the emotion because I believe grief is one of the few places two emotions can live in the same moment, you know? And so walking into that room and seeing him like being devastated that my grandpa had died and incredibly grateful to have the opportunity to take care of this person who took care of me my whole life and in such a special and unique way. And so like when I was able to like get through the initial emotion of that experience and then roll into like the, you know, the tangible tasks attached to embalming my grandpa, like it just, I was just really able to focus in on this reality that what I was doing is I was caring for him. Right. You know, like that, no different than as if I were a healthcare professional and he had broken his leg. You know, like this was the way that I went to school, that I knew how. And him and I had this conversation because he asked me if I would be able to do his funeral, like if that was something I was going to want to do. And I said, absolutely, because of all the care that I had received from him my whole life, that was going to be the way that I knew how to take care of him and in turn take care of his family. You know, like my dad and my uncle and my cousins. And, you know, like I just was able to really connect with that, like the importance of that level of care. And so it was a, you know, for a person that, again, that is not embalming orientated, meaning like it's not my favorite thing to do, why I appreciate the process so much is like that was just a shell and I was able to connect with that. But like that shell housed an incredible amount of experiences with me and my family members. So like, even though he was dead, that part of him was no less important to us. Right. So yeah, it's a really, you know, it's a really unique experience to have been able to do that, you know, and I've actually cared for three of my grandparents, you know, through my roles as a funeral director and embalmer. And not in every case did I, you know, participate in the embalming, but was always a part of all of their care, you know, their funeral arrangements and working the funeral and, you know, helping dress and cast it and do these different things. Because again, it was just me, it was just an extension of all of the intentional effort that they had put into me my entire life, you know, and, you know, I'm not a fan of like, I'm not personally like a self-made person because I'm just a product of all these people that cared a lot about me. And so, yeah, it was just, I think it's this really kind of unique position of course it's difficult. Of course it's really hard to do. But in that exact same moment, you're just like, but you kind of don't want anybody else to do it.
Thank you for sharing so openly and vulnerably. I just want to acknowledge that it's not easy to talk about this stuff. And I really feel very privileged to be let into your gigantic heart. You said something that was interesting that I think would be a good segue to the next sort of part of the talk. You said, I love grief. And you said something like, I'm unapologetic about that.
Yeah.
So I did want to talk to you about embalming. And I feel like you just crushed that segment, so to speak. And I definitely am interested in talking more about the grief component. And I mean, there's so much to unpack there, but I think maybe if you could let me know and the audience know why you love grief so much.
Yeah, I love it because the things that I'm learning about grief and like, I feel like grief is constantly teaching you based on the season of life that you're in, you know, because I don't believe like grief is not a linear experience, nor is it, I don't think it never ends either. You know, because again, like if I think of my personal experiences with grief of like, even talking about my grandpa today, you know, I get to reshare my relationship with my grandpa, but it's still through a brand new lens and perspective and a new season of life, right? You know, like I'm talking about it with kids that are older now, and I'm talking about it, you know, in a different platform, and I'm talking about, so it's just like again, it's nonlinear, and there's no end to it. I hope I'm still, you know, disconnected to talking about my grandpa when I'm a grandpa. You know, or if I become a grandpa, right? Like, and I want to talk about it with that unapologetic emotion, because like, if that's what I'm feeling, you know, why are we resisting so hard to allow that to be a part of the story, right? Other than somebody else's, you know, we're typically what it is, you know, people are afraid to make you uncomfortable because of the loss that I'm experiencing. And I think that's a real bullshit thing. Like, I think we need to change the narrative on that. I should have asked probably at the beginning of this if there's a disclaimer about swearing or not. But I will continue to speak openly and tell me not to. But so why I'm in love with grief is actually that's a really easy thing for me, because grief is now the place that I continue to feel the presence of the people that I love. You know, grief is the space that I still get to talk. And like, when I tell you that story about my grandpa, like, I mean, like, I literally feel him, like, in the muscles and the tissues and the emotion of my body, you know, like, he's here with me. And like, what I love so much about it is, like, why I love it so much is my grandpa was a teacher. And so every time I get to educate on grief and I get to include him in that, like, to me, it's a part of his legacy. You know, like, this is, I'm teaching in a completely different setting that he taught in. But so much of it is just like this lineage of these things that were a part of our relationship. So, and I think it's important when we talk about grief too, is one of the big things I really speak to is trying to help people recognize that grief is our emotional and behavioral response to loss, not specifically to death. So we're really good about attaching grief to when somebody dies, because it's a very obvious example of like the physical separation of the relationship, right? You know, but so much of it is just like, you know, we are living in an entire world, in my opinion, that is grieving right now. You know, like the lost sense of normalcy, the lost access to family and friends, the lost opportunity, you know, attached to a lot of people's incomes, and the lost, like everything, right? Lost relationships, like, you know, like, I can almost like exclusively reapply this entire conversation into when somebody, say, loses a relationship, like when a relationship ends, like a breakup or a divorce, or, you know, like these different types of things. And I think, again, I don't want to like blanket this, but my experience has been that society has not done a really good job of creating space for those types of loss to grieve. And like, there's so many parallels. And so I just think like we have such an incredible opportunity, you know, to reapply these experiences and lessons of grief, you know, that we've learned in some of the hardest environments, you know, when people lose a child, when people lose somebody they love that has died by suicide, when, you know, like these really, really intense experiences of grief, you know, that there's so much that we can learn from that and start to reapply it into new settings, right? Yeah. And so I just like, I think I'm so fascinated with grief and I'm so in love with grief because grief is an emotion, right? You know, like it is by definition, grief is an emotion, and it's just, but it's such a big emotion because grief can be anger and grief can be happiness and grief can be depression and grief can be acceptance and grief can, you know, like it can be any of these things. And oftentimes it's two of those things at the exact same time, right? You know, and like, I think that's always what's so hard. Like, I think of like a friend of mine that, you know, lost a relationship to divorce. And it was like, you know, when the divorce finally went through, it was just like this sense of relief that part of her life was finally over because it had such a negative impact on her and her kid's life. But like, still was attached to like pure devastation that it didn't work out. Right. And like, I just think both of those things can live in the exact same moment, and neither one of them requires like explanation, you know? And I think that's where, as a world, like we would look at that person typically and say like, well, why are you so sad? He was an asshole, right? Well, yes, he was, but it doesn't mean she's not allowed to be sad about it.
He was my asshole.
And like, you know, here's the thing about relationship. You know, I'm sure there are exceptions, but very few people enter into meaningful and long-term relationship under the impression that someday it's going to end, you know, horribly. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So of course there's grief attached to that, you know, and I think like, you know, and then we reapply that not just to her, but then to the kids that were a part of this relationship and their moms and dads that are a part of, like, so it's just like, it's such a, like, grief just grows so exponentially, right? You know, because it's such an intense emotion. And I love it because like, I'm really fascinated by human behavior. And I think one of the really neat things about grief is like I've just never seen two people grieve in the exact same way. Like, it's just such a personal experience. And I think it has the opportunity to be an extremely meaningful experience if we can learn to sit in the discomfort.
Yes. Man, I have just so many follow-up questions, but I'm really glad that you touched on the idea that grief is not solely related to death, because I think that's a really huge misunderstanding that a lot of us have. And I've not heard it directly connected to loss specifically in the way that you have, but I've talked to people and I've written and talked about this idea that when you leave a relationship, to continue your example, or you leave a job or you move away, right? Something has to go, right? And so when you break up with a partner, for example, you lose them, but you also lose that future that you had planned together, and you lose the expectations that you had, which was, we're not going to break up.
Right.
And you lose so many different things. And there's a loss that is required when those endings occur. And when there is that loss, there is a grief. There's a grieving to do. Even if you are in a dysfunctional, emotionally abusive relationship that you know you need to leave, that everybody is supporting you to leave, it is still going to require grieving, because you're still losing that part of your life, and you're still losing those dreams and goals and expectations, right? And so I think it's really important to touch on that, that it's not just about death that we're talking about.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what happens when we start to transition that mentality, and, you know, like when, again, when I, you know, speak in formal settings, really the things that I spend a lot of time talking about is, number one is awareness, you know, trying to identify the places that loss can live. So, you know, using that relationship as an example, right? That, like, and, you know, you look at the lost sense of security, that lost sense of identity, that lost sense of purpose and future, you know. And I think of our friend that, you know, this guy was an asshole, but, like, he had a really wonderful mom, and I hope he listens to this, had a really wonderful mom and a really wonderful sister, you know, which that also changed the dynamic of those relationships moving forward. Right. So it's an incredible amount of loss that takes place in those experiences. And to me, it's like, where loss lives, grief will follow. Like, that's just, that is absolutely a part of my being, you know, and I think the only way to get through grief is to grieve. And I think, you know, the only way that that happens is if, like, people can learn to, like, also have awareness of, like, the, you know, like, the many levels attached to loss, so that they can properly then acknowledge us in that space, right? And, like, one of my favorite quotes of 2021 is Parker Palmer says, the human soul does not want to be advised or fixed or saved. It simply wants to be witnessed exactly as it is. And, like, it's so impactful in this relationship and with grief, because I think what people have a hard time with is, like, yeah, okay, like, great, we need to talk more about grief. But the thing is, like, I'm not bringing this to the table with the expectation of you learning how to fix it. Simply all you need to learn to do, like, for the people that you love, is learn how to create space for it, you know, for them to feel validated in that loss and feel recognized at each of those places, you know, because, again, these people aren't looking for us to come in and make this better, because that's not a probable outcome. But what is a probable outcome is us to show them support in a way that just simply says, I see you in the intensity of this loss, and I'm not going to try to fix you. I'm just going to sit here with you.
Yeah. I think you've touched on two related but distinct ideas that I think it might be helpful to take one at a time. So I think there's the element of personally dealing with grief and all of its associated friends. So how do you grieve in a healthy manner? And then how do you support somebody who is grieving or dealing with loss? Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, maybe. Can we do the how do we grieve?
Sure.
How do you suggest that grief occurs in the best way possible?
So I think, again, like, for somebody that's walking through a season of loss, you know, again, so recognizing, again, we want to make sure, like, I repeat myself a lot, because this is a pretty new concept for a lot of people. Grief is our emotional and behavioral response to loss, not specifically to death, right? So let's, you know, broaden that into somebody's just lost their job, okay? But again, if this is their source of income, if this was their sense of identity, you know, a lot of people in North America really hold an identity and a job title. you know, and this is the role that they played in their family, like all of these different things. And they've lost that part of their life for a period of time. You know, it is reasonable to me to believe that they are going to have an emotional and behavioral response to that experience, right? The definition of grief. You know, and again, it does, in my opinion, intensify, like when we get into higher levels of loss or when we lose somebody we love to death. And I think the big thing that we need to try to learn how to do is to learn, in my opinion, how to be appropriately selfish when we experience loss. You know, that like when we look at the days surrounding somebody dying, like, you know, pre-COVID, the response was like, well, unlock the doors and open up the house and let anybody in that wants to stop by, you know, where like people have not intentionally created space for themselves to start to understand and recognize what has changed in their life as a result of this person dying, you know, because like, you know, I've had countless conversations with people that like, you know, we'll have a coffee with them after the days of the funeral. And it's just like, I just can't believe how much I miss going to the hospital. You know, who would ever imagine missing going to the hospital? But, well, of course, you don't miss the hospital. You miss the person you were going there to see every day for the last 3 years, right? You know, so starting to learn how to slow down in those immediate parts of loss and create that same awareness for yourself, like start to identify what is going to change in my life as a result of this loss, you know, and then create space for it. And again, the trick to that, in my opinion, in the immediate parts of it is then to be able to create that awareness, truly acknowledge yourself in those spaces, but not go to this immediate expectation of having to fix it or having to make it better. Because to me, what happens is like, if we could offer ourselves really the privilege of awareness and acknowledgement in the immediate parts of loss, it would create predictability. And I really believe there's comfort in predictability, right? You know, so now all of a sudden when I'm having a hard time, you know, and I'm sitting in the discomfort of not going to the hospital, or, you know, this is the first time I had to, you know, make breakfast for myself in 11 years or whatever it is, right? You know, like I'm thinking of the partnership that I have with my wife, Bailey, and it's just like, you know, like our roles, you know, very much complement one another. You know, and there are things that we each do for one another and for our family that if one of us was pulled out of the equation, it would be really hard on the other person. And so what happens now when you reinsert yourself into this life that you knew without that person or without that relationship? And it's a really big deal. So I think like learning how to create that acknowledgement and awareness of that and then removing the pressure. And, you know, because when we remove pressure, the things that it removes, in my opinion, is it removes guilt and shame. And like guilt and shame have never made anything better, ever, in my opinion, right? So it's just like, you know, we don't, if you're a widow, if you're somebody that just lost their job, like you don't need to feel bad, like you don't need to feel shameful about being unemployed. Or you don't need to feel guilty that, you know, you don't know what account the bills get paid from. Like that's perfectly okay, and like we're going to help you figure that out, right? And so I just think like for people that are walking through loss, you know, really what it boils down to for me is just like if we could learn to offer ourselves the same amount of patience and kindness that we would offer somebody else that had just walked through that same loss, how much better would we be, right? You know, like our I think initial response when we see somebody else hurting, for a lot of people is to just create kindness and to create space for them to experience that. And, you know, that we take the pressure off of them. Like you don't have to figure this out right away. But then when we personally walk through stuff, we take a totally different approach to it. We have such a high level of accountability on ourselves. And I don't know that that's completely necessary.
Yeah. So I'm hearing you say to not put a lot of pressure on yourself, to be aware of any guilt or shame that is occurring. And I think one example that came up for me that wasn't mentioned that I'm sure you relate to would be feeling joy and being happy. Like I shouldn't be having a good day. I should be feeling miserable and then piling the guilt and shame on that way.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because like, here's one of the things about I've really learned in settings of grief is why that becomes so important. You know, it's like why acknowledging the hard parts of loss becomes so important is because if you don't, if you say like, oh, I need to just get out of the house or I need to get over this. What happens is when you find yourself in a joyful moment, you feel very undeserving. You know? So if we want to experience the, you know, the joy, if we want to experience, you know, the ebbs and the flows, like the highs of, and like, and there can be an incredible amount of joy in grief. Hard to believe it, but it's really true. You know, but like in order for us to genuinely experience it at that level, we have to experience and give ourselves permission to have a hard moment or a bad day or a bad week. You know, like, again, maybe it's more exclusive to the settings I grew up in. I think it would be broader, but we were not typically raised in environments that we allowed people to have a bad day, bad week, bad month, bad year. And I really think that's okay. You know, like that we learn how to do that. Because then what happens is like, you know, if I sit in the discomfort of grief and I sit in, so like talking about my grandpa, like earlier in this conversation, if I'm willing to allow that emotion to be present and I'm willing to, you know, to feel, you know, genuinely still feel the hurt attached to him not being alive anymore, it becomes incredibly joyful for me to be able to share with you all the parts of my grandpa that still are a part of my life, right? You know, but typically what happens is when I cut the emotion short, I also don't feel like I deserve to get to elaborate too much on the happy stuff. Mm. And so, yeah, I think that's incredibly, you know, I'm really glad that you brought that up, because, you know, there's a guy, his name is David Kessler. He's he and Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote something called The Stage Theory Attached to Grief. And it was really misinterpreted as being this like linear experience. That was not Kessler's or Kubler-Ross's intention, but that's just how it was taught. But he recently came out with like the sixth stage, and I think it was he had a son that died. And after walking through within a personal experience, he talked about like the sixth stage of grief being, you know, when we find meaning in our loss. And I think sometimes, again, like I loved that when I heard this, like I really loved what he said about it. The thing that I think we sometimes fail at as humans is like we would like to skip all of the emotion and the pain and just get right to the meaning, right?
Yeah.
Like it's just like, listen, like if you don't allow yourself to like to experience the entirety of what grief has to offer you, you're never going to get to that meaningful part of it. You know, because the meaning typically comes from the hardship and understanding the contrast attached to the good days and the bad days.
Mm. Or even just simplifying it right down to the emotion is the meaning.
Yeah.
It's like you're supposed to feel deeply right now.
Right.
About life. This means you're fully alive.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I mean, you've done so many funerals now that I'm certain that there would be uncomfortable outbursts of laughter or joy or, you know, recognition of, oh, you know, crazy Uncle John, he used to always do that thing. And everybody, you know, kind of smiles and remembers and loves that part of that person while at the same time grieving the loss of them and that they'll never see that crazy little thing again.
Yeah. It's an incredible, I don't know what else to say. Like I've always said, it's such a unique privilege to be a funeral director, right? To sit at the table with these families, you know, and watch them, you know, to experience laughter in the midst of genuine tears and emotion, you know, that like you can, that's why I'm so convinced about two emotions being a part of the same moment. Because again, like, yeah, like you share the story of like your mom or your dad's thing that they used to do and thinking about that made you so incredibly happy. And then like within that same exact moment, it just made you miss them that much more.
Yeah.
And like, I love it. Like, I'm just so in love with those moments.
Do you remember the that movie Good Will Hunting with Robin Williams?
Yes.
And he talks about his wife farting in her sleep or whatever. And how that was such a significant thing that he misses. And his idea was that you really sincerely miss the little things, right?
Yeah.
The little annoyances and But so you've opened the door to the second part, which is, you know, how do you help people to grieve? What do you do? What do you say?
I think the biggest part of that is, and like, you know what, this is a pretty, I just have re-entered this again, like why I really appreciate the opportunity to continue to talk about this so much is I'm continuing to learn so much. Like, I think honestly, the way I answer this question probably would have been different 3 months ago than it is now. My wife and I were in February, it doesn't really matter, but like, you know, a couple months ago, the two of us went to Canmore, which is a mountain town here in Alberta. And, you know, we were just there to kind of just disconnect for a few days. And there's this like cool little bookstore in Canmore. And we stopped and had a conversation with the lady there. I just said, I'm looking for some books about grief. What was that one? The Wild Edge of Sorrow, right? You recommended that to me? And
Francis so Weller.
Like, yeah. So was looking for that along with some other stuff. And so she, anyways, this lady ended up helping me. She's such a kind person. And then I said, like, have you read any of these? Like, do you have any experience with these? Like, you know, because I get a lot of people ask me about like, you know, hey, my so-and-so's mom or dad passed away. Do you have a book I can recommend to them? And she said, I haven't, but she said, I think it's important, you know, that I'm a widow, that my husband died. And so we leaned in, and like, when I hear that, for me, I'm, you know, you have to remember I've been practicing this for the last 16 years of my life. So like, I'm like, now I'm like, well, okay, we're going to switch gears. Like, I'm like, who, what's your husband's name? Is it okay if I ask, you know, number one, if you're going to enter into a space of grief, if somebody else's grief, ask for permission. Like, I'm not entitled for this person to share their experience with me. Right. So is it okay if I ask you about your husband? Absolutely. It is, you know? You know, and so I leaned in and said, well, when did he pass away? You know, what's number one, what's his name? You know, and so like, now I'm approaching this conversation again from an outsider point of view. It's not a personal loss anyways. And so she tells me about her husband. She tells me about their experience. I ask about the experiences of what it was like, you know, in the community and like with your family and with your friends. And then talked about, like I said, you know, why I'm trying to pursue these resources. And I said, you know, I just get a lot of people ask me, you know, for a list of books or whatever the case is to send to somebody that's experienced loss. And she said, she's like, what needs to happen is those people need to read the books. Stop creating work for the person that just lost somebody. You know, she's like, when my husband died, the last thing I wanted to do was be handed a book and be given this checklist of stuff that I needed to do to make myself better. What would have made it better is if you took on the responsibility of learning about grief and loss so that you could better show up for me instead of creating work for me in one of the most chaotic times of my life. I was like, holy shit. Like, I, you know, like, again, like, I've been at this like over 16 years or over 15 years. I'm like, of course. Like, it's just so obvious, right? Yeah, you're just like, in what world is it reasonable to create more expectation of the person whose life just got flipped up, upside down, right?
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is the worst week of your entire life. Yeah. I recommend that you read this book while this is happening.
Yeah, have you heard of The Wild Edge of Sorrow?
Yeah.
Right? And you just like, and you hear that out loud from a widow, and you're like, it's just like, it was so obvious. And like, and it, I never ever would have thought of that. I just thought, you know, like, I guess you always just drop off a book, either it's lasagna or a book. I don't know. I guess that's a great gift for somebody that's experienced loss, you know, and same thing with the food, where it's just like, you know, you wouldn't believe how many families I've had conversations with. They were like, if I see one more fucking lasagna, you know, like, because like our love language is food. Well, you got to eat, you know, and it's just like, yeah, maybe we have the opportunity to be more intentional, you know, about the things that we do for people that walk through hard stuff. And so the first thing that I say is like, you know, number one, at the very beginning of it is, before you offer yourself to somebody else that is experiencing loss, make sure you're in a position to show up for them. Do not hand out a meaningless invite. And that happens a lot, right? You know, like people that are in busy seasons of their life, you know, whether it's with work or whether it's with family, like, you know, like, again, the setting that we're in, like, we own three businesses. We have three kids that are involved in extracurricular things, you know? So number one, like, before or I call and say, hey, Jerry, you know, I'm sorry about your dad. If you need anything, please let me know. Am I actually in a position to follow through on that? Right? Because like, you know, if I've created this space to say to you, like, if you need anything, you let me know. And then you reach out and you try to take me up on that offer and I'm unavailable to you, it's going to make it really hard for you to trust the next person that said that.
Yeah. So if I'm like, yeah, man, I'm feeling super lonely. And like, can you bring some food by on Saturday and we can hang out for a bit?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, the kids at the game.
Yeah. I've got, how's May 17th sound though? Yeah. You know, I've got a little room in the schedule, like from 2 to 3 PM on a random Wednesday. Like, right. Mm-hmm. So like, it is really important that you attach accountability to yourself before you put yourself in a position. Cause I think it would be really powerful if people started to say like, hey, you know, I heard about your dad. It was important to me that you heard from me. And, you know, I wish I was in a position to offer help right now. It just, in fairness to you, I want to be respectful of the fact that I don't know if I'm in a position to be there for you, but I still want you to know that I'm thinking about you, right? Mm. That's extremely powerful, in my opinion.
And very, you know, boundaried. It's a healthy boundary.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything the matter with that at all, because, like, what happens is, like, again, I don't serve either one of us if I sign up to help you when I'm not in a position, because who pays the price for that? Well, my family does,
right?
You know, and I lived a long part of my career without those boundaries, you know, and what ended up happening is I ended up living in this place of, I was always distracted by where I wasn't. Meaning if I was at work, I was distracted by what was going on at home. And if I was at home, I was distracted by what was going on at work, which never allowed me to truly be present. And so I'm a huge fan of those boundaries and that personal accountability, because here's, and I think it's so, so important when it comes to grief, because like, if I give a disingenuine invite or offer, you know, that you call me whenever you need, if you need anything, you let us know. And I'm not in a position to follow through with that. And you try to take me up on that offer. I think there's a really good possibility that you don't ask somebody else for help.
Mm.
Right? Or if you get two or three of those in a row, and then it's like, what does that do to the person that is trying to grieve? You know, like, we haven't actually surrounded them with the help that they require. So I think if we could have a much higher level of accountability at the beginning of the process, so that people aren't left feeling so alone in the midst of their grief by, you know, just by the fact that typically when we talk about, again, specifically the setting I'm most familiar with, so when somebody dies, you know, once the funeral is over, we, the rest of the world, go back to our normal lives, right? We're back to work, back to dance, back to hockey practice, back to whatever, you know, like, our lives resume and you're left there to pick up the pieces. And so I think, like, are we genuinely going to put ourselves in a position to continue walking alongside that family member or that friend, or are we not in a position to do it? And I don't think you have to feel bad if you're not in a position to do it. Just don't offer yourself if you're not able.
Because then you might show up to console the person, but then you're resenting it. And then that creates an energy that is 100%. Felt. It's like, I don't want to be here right now. Like, I shouldn't have said yes. I've got other things, or you're checking your phone. And
yeah, and you think in the midst of me, you know, losing something or someone very important to me, I want to add on the guilt of feeling like I've inconvenienced you.
Yeah.
Right. Like, yeah. Not a hard, you know, again, it's not a hard thought process, you know, when we really break it down, but I think we just all feel this like initial instinct is to immediately go outward when somebody experiences loss. And my thing is, I always recommend inward before outward, right? Like, turn in, really evaluate what this means to you and to your life and to your family and the people that are most important to you before you go back out, you know. And a great example of this would be, you know, when we had a young person in our community, Hayden, passed away in a farming accident. And, you know, he was 11 years old at the time when he died. And we are friends with his mom and dad. And I remember when the accident happened, he didn't die immediately. He got airlifted out and was in the hospital for a few days. And even before Hayden had passed away, I actually reached out to his dad, Barry, and I called and I just said, hey, listen, like, as your friend, I just need you to know, like, that I am thinking about you, that we are thinking about you. And I don't know what it means. I just needed you to know that that you are absolutely on our hearts, you know. And it wasn't an offer. It wasn't a, you know, like, it was just like, it was just that emotional connection, which I still find there can be incredible support in that. Right. And then, like, between, you know, Barry explained to me what had happened, and it didn't sound like things that Hayden was going to recover. So, you know, my next few days, or my next even whatever hours, was unpacking what did this look like for us, you know, me as an individual, and then for my wife and for our kids on a personal level before we re-entered that world in a professional capacity, right? Because if I don't create this space to be an individual, to be a human being in the midst of that, I think we fall short as professionals.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because one of my questions was, how do you work with children in grief? Like, how do you talk to kids about death?
Yeah, super. Like, actually, that question is, that's like, that was like how death ed started, you know? And the reason, what I mean by that is, like, my favorite group of the demographic to work with is kids. Because I think, like, kids are just really incredible to talk to. I think kids are so much smarter than we give them credit for. And, you know, and working with them in a really vulnerable environment, like in a funeral home setting, they just offer so much beauty, you know, because, like, it's like they're not old enough to know better. Right. You know,
yeah, they're so pure.
Like, yeah. And like, so it's just like, you know, we like, so when we sit in some of the settings of the funeral home setting, it's like, you know, it's just like, my experience is just like, you got to get down on their level. Like, you know, like, we have in our funeral home, we actually have like a playroom, like there's toys and, you know, coloring books and all these things, and like snacks and juice boxes and the whole works, you know, and it's just like, and then you just sit down and we just start talking about that relationship, you know. Tell me about your grandma, or tell me about your grandpa. And like, you know, do you know who I am? No, I don't. Well, my name's Jeremy. And you know, I'm the person that your family asked to help take care of grandpa. So do you remember when you were at the hospital and when great grandpa died, you know, or when grandpa passed away? Yeah, I remember that. So, well, one of the things that we do is we brought grandpa back to our care, back here to the funeral home, and we've been helping take care of him, you know? And so I'm always into like what I call age appropriate truth, meaning the way I approach this conversation with my 4.5-year-old is different than I would talk to my 8-year-old about it, which is different than I talk to my 10-year-old about it, right? So you got to be very intentional about the way that you talk to kids. But the reality of it is like, you know, I think if kids have experienced were a part of that relationship, then they're old enough to be a part of the conversation, you know? And I think we have to stop, you know, sending them into the other room or sending them downstairs to play while the adults talk. I think it's perfectly acceptable for them to be present. And I think it's perfectly acceptable for my kids to see the emotion attached to what happens when somebody we love dies, you know, and that it's not easy, that there's hardship attached to this. Because then what's going to happen is they're also going to see us laugh, and they're going to see us cry, and they're going to see us eat, and they're going to see us drink, and they're going to see us whatever, right? You know, like, they're going to be a part of really what's called mourning, right? Where we activate our loss and participate in our grief. Well, by every definition, that's mourning, you know? And again, I think we just have such a better opportunity to allow children to be a part of the mourning experience, because they have grief too. And I just don't think we have to shy away from the conversation of, you know, again, age appropriate truth, you know, depending on what knowledge we need to deliver to them. But yeah, they absolutely deserve a seat at the table.
Yeah, you have this great line on your website that says, normalize difficult conversations without dehumanizing the process.
Yeah.
It's like that. It's like, why don't we, I wrote something a while back about normalizing male tears, like normalize crying in public. Like, we need to do more of this, in my opinion, because it does. Like, you, in those moments of grief or emotion or loss, you are showing your child how to be a healthy, emotionally present, resilient human.
Right.
You're leading like by example.
What behavior do we want to model our children to mimic? Because really what they're doing in those moments is like, you know, why I'm so pro kids being involved is like, those are learning opportunities. You know, if a child loses a great grandparent, you know, to me, like, what a great opportunity for us to teach them what loss and grief and mourning looks like, because it is inevitable that at some point in time, that child is going to lose somebody much closer to them. Right. Mm-hmm. And like all of us, if they have the predictability of experience to be able to lean back and say, like, oh, I remember when great, like, you know, grandma just passed away. Well, what I remember is like when great grandpa died, you know, everybody got together, like we laughed, we cried, we, you know, like it was a safe place to show emotion. It was right. All of these things, you know, that we were still allowed to talk about that person, that we didn't have to hide those parts of the experience. Like, incredible, man. Like, and I think that just changes so much for kids, you know, that, and again, because what kids don't need us to tell them, kids are actually the most, why I love it so much is like, they don't need to know the definition of grief. They don't need to know that grief is your emotional behavioral response to loss, right? They just act it out. So like, you know, when our kids last year, like when, you know, when schools got shut down last year, you know, our kids, I wouldn't say immediately, but very quickly, you know, started to recover from the experience of not being able to go to school, because they had the tools to talk about hard things. You know, we do a thing called the happy crappies. Like it's almost a nightly ritual for us. And it's a summertime thing.
I'm going to need to know more about the happy crappies.
Okay. So it's this like thing that we do basically every night. Like, you know, like supper time is always kind of like our thing, you know, like, oh, I would say almost every night of the week, we eat supper together as a family. And what happens in those moments, like we do this thing called the happy crappies, and it's really where we unpack our days. Right. So it's just like, you know, we used to call it best part, worst part. And then Fred Zavar had said, oh, we do that. This is what we call it anyway. And so what we do is we start to model the behavior of showing them how to talk about the happiest part of their day and the crappiest part of their day as part of one story. Right. And then we, the parents, when we listen to these experiences and we listen to their parts of the day, we give equal response to the crappy part of the day as we do the happy part. That one is not more deserving of our attention than the other, right? That the shitty part of your day is just as important as the really good part of your day. And then you get to decide which one you want to talk more about, because it's your time, right? You got the floor. And like, so when we started this, you know, we started this quite a while ago. You know, it was like, it was really superficial at the beginning because we have young kids, and it was like, oh, the happiest part of my day was, you know, getting fruit by the foot as a snack, and the crappiest part of my day was, you know, Dylan stole my toy. Well, okay, you know, that is crappy. Sorry to hear that happen. You know, did you guys resolve it? Yeah, we did. Okay, do we need to talk more about it? No, we don't. Okay, glad to hear it. You know, and like, so it was like, you know, pretty superficial at the beginning. But now, like, you know, my 10-year-old daughter, my 8-year-old daughter, and I've got a 4.5-year-old son, like, it is incredible watching their emotional intelligence grow. You know, like where, like we end up in, like when we re-entered this, you know, this lockdown, and we were coming into the Christmas season, and explaining to our kids, you know, like not being able to see family, or not being able to see friends, or not being able to do things, you know, and like, I remember one of them was just like, you know, let's do the happy crappy. So what was the happiest part of your day? And it was like, well, the happiest part of my day was like going to the tobogganing hill. All right. On what was the crappiest part of your day? I'm really starting to miss my friends. You know, it's not the same, you know, going to the hill with your sister and your brother. Like, you know, I really miss meeting up with my group of friends, you know, like that. It just feels different. And it's like, yeah, it does. Like, let's lean into that, right? And let's unpack that, because I don't want you to have to carry that around for the entire season attached to this pandemic.
Yeah, the self-awareness, you know, of that as well.
Oh man, incredible, right? And like my 4.5-year-old, like he's, you know, he is, I will admit, like I feel like there is a huge difference between the ways, you know, little boys communicate versus little girls. And I, again, honestly, if I can be honest, I think that's a thing we have the opportunity to do a better job of, like, you know, I think we can level up and do a much better job for my son, for example. But like where I watch him grow is like, yeah, his happy crappies at the beginning were, you know, reasonably painful to listen to because it never made sense. But, you know, one day it's just like, you know, his happy recently was just like, actually, this was my favorite response to date. Bo, what's your happy crappies? No, I don't want to. I said, why not? because I'm having a bad day. And I was like, okay, man, you know what? We're not going to force you to do this then. Right. Like 4.5 years old. And like, he just knew that, like, he just wasn't in a position to talk about it. Whatever was going on in his world and his head, it was enough that, like, he wasn't going to force himself into this space to talk about something he didn't want to talk about.
Respect, right? The boundaries. Oh, God. On that kid.
I was like, I looked at my wife, Bailey, and was like, what happened here? You know, and like, it was just like, it was so amazing. Right. And then, like, you know, at the end of the day where we create the opportunity, you know, so it's like, then at bedtime, it's like, you know, hey, man, like, how come you had such a hard day? Right. Mm. So again, like, respect that boundary, but then, like, pursue it. You know, but why I love the happy crappies is what it does is it gave us, the parents, the opportunity to model the behavior of talking about the good parts of our day and the bad parts of our day, right? You know, and if I'm having a good day, you know, I just say, you know what, I don't have a crappy. I'm super grateful for today. I'm super grateful to be having supper with you. And, you know, nothing happened in my day today that was so bad that I feel like I need to talk about it. Mm. You know, and so, like, and that's an okay thing, right? Just like you don't always have to have a good part to your day.
Yeah.
And just modeling that behavior. And I think where that will serve our children really well is when we enter into really hard stuff, you know, if we go through a season of loss, if we enter into an environment of grief, I know that they will have that experience to lean on, you know, and I would be the dad that would just be like, look, like, you know, grandpa just died, you know, and have the conversation with them. And then at some point in time, I would say, like, what's the happiest part? And what's the happiest memory you have of your grandpa? Mm. Right. And then I would contrast that with, what are you going to miss the most? You know, so we're maybe not going to call it the same thing, but like, I'm going to show them how to talk about contrasting emotion as part of that environment.
Mm.
Yeah.
I feel like the happy crappies is a child's book or online empire. You better trademark that shit. So I have like one final kind of topic, and I'm conscious of time, but yeah. I'm curious by how, I mean, you every day for hours, the majority of your life are surrounded by death and grief. Mm-hmm. And you are a very sort of genial, uplifting dude. And so I'm curious about any processes that you have or rituals that you kind of don't take on the grief and sadness and sorrow of others and kind of leave that over there, mm-hmm. while also going about your life and you know, trying to create a space or a chasm between that stuff and then your own personal emotions and feelings.
Yeah. So and again, like, this is a concept that I kind of, you know, put words to after starting Death Ed and starting to talk publicly about grief and loss. But ultimately what that comes down to is learning, you know, in professional capacities, how do we emotionally invest in the environments that we serve without emotionally attaching ourselves to the outcome? Right. You know, knowing that, like, and I just, like, I think of that, you know, in so many professions. You know, my brother's a nurse practitioner, you know, like, we've got family that are in, like, whether it's medicine or nurse, you know, like, wherever it is, right? You know, like, anybody that serves other people. You know, my sister-in-law works at the Cross Cancer Institute in Edmonton. And I feel like what, it's my opinion, again, like, I think based on me sharing the knowledge earlier of being the kid that cheated on a diploma exam, obviously education is not my forte. It is not, like, not the place
that's, I got you, bro. You can have one of my degrees.
Like, yeah, man. I just, like,
we're good.
But where I'm going with this is just, like, I think where what is going to separate, you know, the way that we serve our communities, you know, whatever that community is, the way that we serve our communities moving forward is going to be our ability to have emotional intelligence. You know, is our ability to recognize how we can show up, you know, highly emotionally invest into people, you know, and honestly, I think the word for that is just, like, truly acknowledging people and whatever the experiences you're helping with them, without attaching yourself to the outcome. You know, that, like, it is impossible for me to grieve for every family that we serve, you know, because it's just, those aren't my relationships to grieve. And, like, that takes an incredible amount of practice. And the way that I've done that is, like, I have this thing called my order of service, which is kind of a play on words, you know, from funerals where it's like, you know, when we go to a church or a hall or whatever, and it's like the officiant comes and he hands you this sheet of paper and he's just like, okay, here's the order of service, so you know what to follow along to, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you know when to start the slideshow and you know when to start the music and when we're going to end and all these things. And it just kind of gave us this, you know, this checkpoints of what to expect. And so I just recreated this thing I call my order of service for myself, and it's checkpoints. And it starts like, it's a me first thing. Like, how am I serving myself? Am I moving my body? Am I drinking enough water? Am I getting enough sleep? You know, really simple things to find online about how to take care of yourself, you know. But then I take it a step further to the emotional intelligence part of saying, like, you know, am I serving myself, you know, emotionally? You know, am I getting those opportunities to, you know, truly acknowledge myself and take care of myself? And then, like, you know, before, and then, so once I've taken care of myself, you know, then I go into what I call my nuclear family, which is, you know, my partner Bailey and our three kids, you know, and I'm very intentional about it. Like, it's not like I don't group them all together. It's like, what does it look like to be a good partner to Bailey? Am I creating these same opportunities for her to take care of herself that I require to take care of myself? You know, and then I get down to my kids. And again, I don't lump all my kids together. It is very intentional. Like, what does it look like to be a good dad to Harper? What does it look like to be a good dad to Dylan and Bowen, right? And what do each of these people in my life require from me? And that changes like almost like weekly, right? You know, so like, it's just really learning to be in tune with that. And like, by doing that, that is what, you know, really put me in a position that, like, then when I'm in my professional roles, in my professional capacities as a funeral director, that's what actually allows me to be present. Is, you know, I know I've served these people that are the most important to me at a very high level, you know, or to the best that I'm able to. So now that I'm your funeral director, I feel like I'm really in a position to do that for you, right? Mm. You know, and then when I enter into that role, I think, you know, maybe a wonderful, like, way to, you know, to start to wrap up our time together. But it's like, my favorite thing to do is like, from that emotional intelligence aspect of, and again, like, so this is how I emotionally invest. I lead with excruciating vulnerability. I meet you in your place of loss with genuine vulnerability and deep recognition to the experience that you are and are about to walk through, right? Because here's what I've learned in a professional setting, and personal too, but like in my role as a funeral director, when you lead with excruciating vulnerability, it creates a connection. If we create connection, it builds trust. If it builds trust, it will lead to a relationship. And if I build a relationship with you, you will truly enable me to do the job that you trust me to do. Right? And like, that applies universally, in my opinion. Like, there is not a setting that I couldn't reverse engineer that and show you how to do that. Right? And even if you are living in a world of delivering, you know, fatal diagnosis for a living, I still think there's an extremely professional and vulnerable way to do it. Right.
Yeah. Being, doing it heart first. Let's say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And I just think, like, I don't know, Jeremy, but it's my opinion that is what the next level of professionalism is going to look like, is people that can combine knowledge with, you know, a personal approach.
I fully agree with you. And I hope that that is true.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's,
well, I'm all in on it. So like, I'm really banking on it.
Bro, I've got a heart in my logo. Like, I'm invested. I want to make that world happen. And I think that, yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge you, man. That was a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of wisdom that you've just imparted. And I'm really grateful for that. So on behalf of the listener who's listening right now, who's like, holy shit, that was a really good episode. Thank you, man. Thanks for all that you do.
I'll end in the same way we started. Like, I'm just so incredibly grateful to have these opportunities. And I think there's an incredible amount of importance about us learning how to sit in the discomfort of it all, because we've just got so much to learn.
Hang on. Where can people find you? You've got a website.
Yeah. So I'm pretty active on social media. So my social media handle is death_ed. And then you can catch me on, like, Instagram is, honestly, that's kind of my jam. Instagram is definitely my favorite platform. On Facebook as well, pretty active there. I'm also on Twitter, and then the website, yeah, www.deatheded.ca, which is so funny. Like when we set up the website and I sent it to my brother to like have a look at it, he's like it's, it looks like death. I was like, yeah, it does look like death. It doesn't look like Death Ed at all. But it is meant to be pronounced Death Ed, not yeah. Death.
Yeah. You just made a new word like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, brother, thanks again so much. And yeah, this is incredible. Really, really great.
Thanks for allowing me to be here, man. I really appreciate it. So.
So good, right? Super powerful. Grief is our emotional and behavioral response to loss, not specifically to death. What a good episode, hey? What a fucking dude. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you. If you have a chance to push a button, a five-star review would be a wonderful treat. So thanks for your support. Thanks for sharing it. Thanks for subscribing to not miss an episode. I've got a couple really good ones coming up, actually. One or two in which I'm actually really excited to share. I'm excited to share all of them. I don't want to sound like that guy, you know, that's like, oh, some of them are shit. No, they're all good. It's like, what is your favorite toe? They're all my favorite toe. But, you know, sometimes I look down at the big toe and I'm like, man, you look good today, bro. So got some good episodes coming up. And I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with that visual of my toes. So hope you have a good day. Thanks for your support. And I will talk to you soon. Oh, and if you want, follow me on Instagram. I'm at Long Distance Love Bombs. And I've got a book called It'll Be Okay and You Will Be Too. I've got courses. I do coaching. Come into my ecosystem. I think you'll enjoy it. Okay, that's really the end now. Take care. Have fun. Keep smiling.